what dibrands are at the very beginning of the sequence of lectures. And we're saying that they correspond to situations where I allow my worksheet to have some boundaries, rather than just these infinite tubes going to infinite in space, to infinity in space-time. I allow the worksheet to just end at some locations in space-time. Now, in order to discuss this sort of idea, it's important to understand, as I said, first from the point of view of the worksheet theory itself. So I have my theory of scalars, so whatever else should be CFT or quantum field theory. So I can ask, what does it mean to define a quantum field theory on a space-time which has a boundary? So have you encountered any situation like this? If not, what do you think should I do in order to be able to define a quantum field theory, say, on half space, or perhaps on a strip, or something like that? So first of all, are there situations where you might want to have a quantum field theory which is defined on a piece of space-time? What situations can you think of?
Conductor?
Yes, that's right. In condensed matter physics, it's definitely possible that I'm using my quantum field theory to describe a material, and my material ends. In particle physics, it's a bit more difficult to envision a situation like this, obviously, because we don't expect our universe to end. But quantum field theory is definitely something you can think about. So the next question you can ask is, OK, suppose I have a quantum field theory that I can define on a space that ends, just because, yeah, I have a piece of material or something like that. Are there choices involved in how it ends? Or can I just canonically end it?
Choices, right?
There's choices. Right. Yeah, there are choices. Like, even if you tell me the material ends, you might need to tell me how does it end. And maybe I do things where it ends. Maybe I add some a little layer of some other material. So if I have a theory T, I also need to choose. So there must be some data that allows me to talk about a boundary. And there might be different choices of this data. And right, this is extra stuff I'm putting on top of the theory. So it really is some extra structure I added on top of the theory, a prescription on how to make it end. Now, we can totally discuss to which degree this is extra information and to which degree it's something that was contained in the theory. But, you know, abstractly, if you give me some boundary condition, you can always make it more complicated. So if I start from some boundary condition B, I can also take this system and sort of tensor the whole thing with some quantum mechanical system. I can just add some extra degrees of freedom to just leave at the boundary. Not like I take a Hilbert space. So to when I tensor it in my boundary condition, just put there some spin degrees of freedom or something like that. And once I do that, I can even try to deform the system by turning on some boundary interaction. I take some matrix acting in M times some operator. that lives at the boundary. And we can see some examples. After I make the boundary condition more complicated, I can then do some energy flow, try to make it simple again. So there's a whole big zoo of possible boundary conditions for a given theory, even when the theory is very simple. Now, what physical constraints do we want, perhaps, from a boundary condition? That could be, rather than try to describe specific boundary conditions, can we say something general about it? So what are the properties we want from a theory, typically? For example, we typically want the theory to have a stress tensor which is conserved. So we want our theories to conserve energy and momentum. What can I say when I have a boundary? I presumably still want to conserve energy. So remember, this sort of equation is derived how you take a small region and you check how much energy or momentum is coming in, and you set that the total is zero, and you'll use Stokes' theorem or something like that to prove this relation. If you try to do something like that near the boundary, there are sort of two possible sources of energy that might be flowing in and out. There might be energy that flows in from degrees of freedom in the 2D theory, but you might also have some energy which flows in or out from degrees of freedom that are close to the boundary or at the boundary. So what's happening is that the amount of energy that is flowing into the boundary is controlled by the stress tensor with one component perpendicular to the boundary and one component parallel to the boundary. And in order to have energy conservation, this must be the variation in time of some kind of boundary stress tensor. So when you have a situation of a theory with a boundary, you have something that controls the energy momentum in the bulk, and then you might have also something that controls energy which is localized at the boundary. And the change in energy localized at the boundary is the amount of energy that comes in from the bulk. So sort of a general property of two-dimensional or boundary conditions in two-dimensional quantum field theories. I could have put some more indices here to do it in more than two dimensions, but we don't need to. Okay. Now, so this is sort of the properties of boundary conditions in 2D quantum field theory that I will need to in order to discuss deep brains. Do you have any questions? I'm happy to discuss these points at length in the office hours and so on. But
this is for there are extra constraints if the theory is conformal.
Yeah, we'll discuss next. That's right. So for now, we're just looking at generic translation invariant quantum field theory. And then indeed you can ask, okay, under which condition is a boundary condition invariant under Weyl symmetries of the bulk? And that takes a bit of work. So in the bulk, we know that we need the condition like T mu mu equal to zero, the variation of the theory with respect of a diagonal change of the metric vanishes. It takes a little bit more work to figure out what's going on with the boundary. But let me just give you the result. The result is that the boundary stress tensor also has to vanish. And so effectively, this means that the perpendicular component of the stress tensor has to vanish. And if you write it in a... So this is a bit of a weird result, Okay, it's not intuitive at all, at least to me, at first.
What could
and actually,
why could it not be constant? Because then the other one would be zero.
So, this could be constant. I think this is the condition, this is the consequence.
Okay, so that's okay.
Yes. So instead of trying to derive it, I will give you sort of the condition that follows from Birest invariance later on, which is related to this. But so this condition now, I can write it in complex coordinates. It's something like T, the holomorphic T equal to the anti-holomorphic T at the boundary. I mean, there might be a little phase here that depends on the slope of the boundary. Sometimes, I forget if this is for a horizontal or vertical boundary. The other one has a plus, the other has a minus. But just this component is the TZZ minus or plus TZZ bar, Z bar, Z bar component. So, and then if I try to express this for the, so in terms of the scalar fields, it becomes some condition like dx mu dx mu equal del bar x mu del bar x mu. Now, I want to stress that at least classically, there are a whole bunch of boundary conditions for a collection of scalar fields which can be conformal. So, you immediately get a big zoom. When you have a theory which is the product of many theories, you can make boundary condition by just saying, okay, I give a boundary condition for each of the theories. But that's not all. You can give sort of more complicated boundary conditions for the fields of one theory mixed, are constrained to be equal to the fields of the other theory or something like that at the boundary. So I can definitely, start by asking what are the boundary conditions for a single scalar field. I want to stress that by picking an independent boundary condition for all of the scalar fields, we will cover just very few of the options. Okay, and then we'll try to improve on that. And even if I look at a boundary condition for a single scalar field, there are a lot. So in order to make the problem manageable, I will now restrict myself to free boundary conditions for a free scalar field. So, in the same way as a free field is a field whose equations of motions are linear, a free boundary condition is a boundary condition which is linear. And free boundary conditions you can reasonably classify, because you're pretty much saying, okay, I want to put some linear constraint on dx and del bar x such that the square of del x is equal to the square of del bar x. There are not that many possibilities at the end. So we have what's called Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions. Normal boundary conditions tell you that the normal derivative of the scalar field is zero. Dirichlet boundary conditions tell you that the scalar field at the boundary is a constant. So I call this Dirichlet. There is really a family of Dirichlet boundary conditions parameterized by this constant. So intuitively, this describes a situation where the brain, the string, can end anywhere in this direction. At any point in space, it can end. And then you get a condition on the sort of the tension on the. And this does so that the string can only end if it passes by the point x. So if you combine these boundary conditions for various scalar fields, you can do something like, OK, maybe then I get Neumann boundary conditions for x0 all the way to some little d, and Dirichlet boundary conditions for xd plus 1 all the way to d. So this describes a situation where in space-time, I have some special location where I sit at x in the directions d plus 1 all the way to d, and I extend along 0 to d. And my strings can literally end there. So I could have a string propagating what's called an open string, a string whose endpoints are attached to the brain, and it moves along the brain. Now, it should be clear that even just by Lorentz invariant, you can do more things than this. You could have said, I'll rotate that. But with a little bit of imagination, you can try to write more interesting boundary conditions, which are still free. You could say, let me take del x mu and say that this is some matrix times del bar x nu. As long as this matrix is orthogonal, this will be a nice conformal invariant boundary condition. And we could try to unpack d minus 1. We could try to unpack the meaning of these boundary conditions. But I will probably leave it for an exercise.
Why
orthogonal
and not
unitary?
Sorry? Why does the matrix have to be orthogonal?
Oh, because, I mean, here I just have the matrix times itself equal to 1. I'll discuss momentarily what this sort of thing can be. But first, let's just try to describe what are the possible fluctuations of this thing.
That should be a small d, right?
Yes, you're right. Yes. And perhaps I should call this d minus 1 for sensibility. OK. So something that we already seen for closed strings is going to happen again. So now we'll have open string states, which represents the propagation of a string which has actual boundaries of an open string. When we discuss scattering amplitudes, we will have to sort of use some imagination and draw some pictures which might have some open strings and closed strings. For example, let me draw something like this. I'm really bad at drawing, but this could be a three-level process where a closed string splits into open strings. And so, with a bit of imagination, you can see what happens if I do a wild transformation to bring in all of the semi-infinite pieces of the surface. Becomes something like that. There is going to be a vertex operator which represents this closed string state and lives in the bulk. And then there are going to be two boundary vertex operators in this case, which are vertex operators which describe which represent local operators which live at the boundary. So there's going to be some kind of open version of the state operator map where states I can put on a strip become local operators that live at the boundary. Where there is, you can imagine sort of this slicing the strip like this and slicing the disk like that. So there will be a set operator map, there will be vertex operators I can put at the boundary, which are one to one correspondence to states, and there'll be a notion of BRST closed and BRST exact, and so on and so forth. And this kind of condition actually is one way to make sure that I can define the BRST symmetry, but let's not go there, I have a limited amount of time. The point I wanted to describe, so there is another notion in quantum field theory that I want to stress. So another property of quantum field theory is there are local operators. Okay, things you can observe in the bulk. There are also boundary local operators. And a lesson I want to really stress is that there is no relationship between boundary operators and bulk operators. In a generic quantum field theory, the questions you can ask in the boundary are just different from the questions you can ask in the bulk. In a free theory, in a perturbative theory, both will be written roughly as polynomials in your fields, but renormalization will work in a different way. So the normalized expressions will be different. And also the disorder operators you can place when you have disorder operators will be different in the bulk and in the boundary. So this is a cautionary point. So you just have to sort of start from scratch, quantize the theory in a strip, and then figure out a state operator map between states on a strip and vertex operators at the boundary. And it will be still true that sort of the physical states for the string theory correspond to operators on the boundary which have scaling dimension 1. And these are the same operators that you could imagine adding to the a boundary action, to the form of the boundary, in a conformally invariant way, at least in leading order in perturbation theory. So again, there is this correspondence between studying the possible ways I can deform the boundary condition and the states and fields that I find make out of open strings. So in the same way as the deforming the space-time where the string theory lives is something that I do by making coherent state of strings, deforming the D-brain the strings attached to is something I can make out of a coherent state of open strings. So, let's now try to think. If I have a sort of boundary conditions here, what possible nice operators of scaling dimension 1 I could write? Well, first of all, I can try to do things of the form e to the ip x at the boundary. restricted to the boundary. This, of course, only works if I use Neumann directions, not Dirichlet, because the Dirichlet boundary condition, the scalar field is a constant at the boundary, so there is no point making an operator that observes the value of that constant. And so here I need to sort of take the directions 0, 2d plus 2d minus 1. Which kind of makes sense. This is going to describe some open string that moves with some momentum. And it moves with some momentum along the brain because it's stuck to the brain. It cannot move in a direction perpendicular to the brain. So that makes sense. And also this, you can do some kind of open string tachyon. Which describes the fact that in bosonic string theory, not only the space-time itself is unstable, there is a tachyon, but even also the dibrands you can put in this theory are unstable. In superstring theory, there is no tachyon, and there are dibrands which have no tachyon. So you can talk about these dibrands in a sensible way. Next, I can try to put a del x in here. Interestingly enough, I can do this both in the Neumann and in the Dirichlet directions. In Dirichlet boundary conditions, x is fixed, but the normal derivative of x is free. And so the Lomofsky derivative of x is also unconstrained. I mean, it's equal to the anti-Lomofsky one, but it's a thing. So I don't gain anything putting del bar here instead of del x, but I can put either of them. And same for Neumann. And so I get both two sorts of set of fields. One of them is intuitive. You can argue that if you add this to your boundary action, you're just shifting x, little x. So these are this control transverse fluctuations. Turning on a coherent state of the states changes the shape of your D-brain. On the other hand, these ones are funny. They have some kind of polarization along the brain. And staring at them for a while, you can convince yourself that they behave like gauge fields on the brain. So these D brains have both a tachyon, has something that describes the fluctuations, but they also have a weird gauge field. And why a gauge field? Well, what's going on is that at the end point of a D-brain behaves like a particle. And if I were to write an action for a particle, the first thing I could do is to couple it to a gauge field. So there is sort of a... So this gauge field, it has a property that the endpoints of strings are charged under it. Conversely, if you turn on a constant field strength for this gauge field, you're creating a situation where the endpoints of the D-brain or the strings get pulled along the D-brain. So the endpoints are not free, sort of, but they feel a force. And indeed, that M is actually something like e to the f, it turns out. So roughly. If you have a field strength is an anti-symmetric matrix. If you exponentiate it, you get an orthogonal matrix. And turns out it's that. So these boundary conditions describe a situation where you have, for generic M, where you have just a space-filling brain, and there is a force pulling the endpoints in some direction. But there is a weird phenomenon that if you, so this is true at least when F is small compared to alpha prime. There is an alpha prime in here, doesn't matter. But when F becomes large enough, then M might become a reflection matrix, and then suddenly you find yourself with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So it's a, here there are all sort of, you know, weird, weird aspects that we, of the story, you know. Dirichlet and Neumann look very different from each other, but you can kind of interpolate between them. There is a very nice and rich space of boundary conditions for the scalar fields. And some of these boundary conditions have an intuitive geometric meaning, but other ones are really not probing the stringy nature of geometry. And the same way as we saw for t-duality, you can find bizarre relations. If you push your parameters away from sort of the low energy effective action. But you know, this, as we have this shape and gauge field deformations, you can imagine that you have really deep brains that have very complicated shapes or gauge fields or none. And there will be some equations of motion for these shapes and for these gauge fields, which come from the vanishing of beta functions. So if you try to turn on a general shape or a general gauge field, classically it will be fine. At one loop, though, this condition will start breaking down. This condition will start breaking down. You'll find a non-zero t parallel at one loop. And forcing it to vanish will give you equations of motion that constrain the shapes and gauge fields for these deep brains. With a bit of work, you can try to write an action. It's called the DBI action. I don't think I'll be able to. I hope I wrote it, but I might have forgotten to write it. And I might not be able to remember it fully by hand, in my head. But it's something like that. It's roughly a minimal area action, so it's very intuitive. Again, it's reasonable. The closed strings at low energy give you gravity, plus higher order corrections. And if you have some object in gravity, it kind of has to move around, actually. You cannot define a rigid, unmovable object in gravity. But also, the way it moves around is, at leading order, is always a minimal area sort of thing. And then you can add, on top of that, some higher curvature corrections that control the rigidity or some nonlinearities in the response. So you get something like, square root of just. It's roughly the area, okay? So square root of I don't know how to call the coordinates, the positions of this d-brain. Let me call them y's, something like dy mu over del sigma a, some determinant, dy nu over del sigma b, and then something like g mu nu, and actually you get something like g mu nu plus f mu nu here, something like that. So you get a weird action that combines the gauge field, the field, the bulk fields, and the shape. You can find it in the Bolshinsky. That sort of tells you how these d-brains behave at the leading order in alpha prime. So So proceeding this way, you can define a whole collection of D-brains. You can compute scattering amplitudes at tree level or whatever, Arrigo-Gaussian perturbation theory. You can find effective action and so on and so forth. Now, there are some. So I would like to focus on sort of the novel things that happen when you have D-brains, which can be really unexpected. And I want to discuss carefully the notion of Champaton bundle. So the fact that, as I mentioned here, you can take a boundary condition and just take multiply by some vector space, which effectively means sort of taking multiple copies of your boundary condition, saying, OK, I have my system, my theory, my fields, but they can end in multiple ways. I need to keep track of this multiplicity. So, so suppose I have a system on a strip, a boundary condition B, but I take n copies of it. So the rules of the game are that the space of states of the system is just the space of states if I had the original boundary condition. So let me sort of call it HBB. Tensored with CN twice. One from the, it's just nothing deep. OK, I'm adding some extra quantum mechanical freedoms, like a spin system on the left boundary and a spin system on the right boundary. And so the Hilbert space of the system is the quantum field theory Hilbert space times the Hilbert space of the spin system on the left and the right boundary. So the state of space gets multiplied by n matrices.
Why does the left and right boundary have to be the same?
They didn't. I could have had B prime and M prime, and then I would have put an M prime here. Absolutely. But let me keep it simple for a moment, and then I'll get it more complicated. So, but there is state operator map. So if my my space of states got bigger, my state of operators also needs to be bigger. And that's indeed the case. If I'm here, I can take any any old boundary operator and multiply it by a matrix which acts on the spin degrees of freedom. So I just take a local operator acting on the spin times a local operator acting on the quantum field theory degrees of freedom, and that's the local operator in this combined thing. So the state operator map maps matrices times operators to matrices times states. OK. But that means that all of my, you know, all of my open string states become matrices. And intuitively, what's going on is that I have like multiple copies of my D-brain just sitting on top of each other. And when I look at an open string, I need to tell you which copy does it start on and which copy does it end on. So everything becomes n by n matrices. Everything, including the positions, the transverse positions of these brains, so the transverse position that, let me call the denote them as y mu, naively, the one that tells me, you know, the fields that are telling me what's the shape of the D-brain, they get promoted to some matrix value fields. And that is really weird. What does it mean for the transverse position of a brain or a collection of brains to be a matrix? So in order to see what's going on, you can try to write down an effective action. It takes a little bit of work. Or you can try to look at some scattering of these scalar fields, or these open string modes. And you find that the effective action of these scalar fields is the following. There is like what you could expect, a dy squared term, kinetic term, at leading order, but there is also something like y mu commutator y nu squared. So you can just compute that there is a disk amplitude which has four legs and whose contribution shows that it is the case. Or you can just do the beta function. You can say, okay, suppose that I take my Dirichlet boundary conditions and I add something like a matrix, something like a y matrix times the x boundary log deformation. What does the beta function look like? It's a totally doable calculation. I invite you to do it, and you'll find that the beta function has some commutator of the y is equal to zero. Something like the beta function for y, something like y commutator y, or something like that. So what's going on is that although you could, in principle, turn on these matrices, in practice, they really want to be diagonal or diagonalizable, to commute with each other. So if you try to make the matrices big, in particular, they will become diagonal, and you'll have just a position of a bunch of brains. But when the brains are sufficiently close to each other, you really have this n squared degrees of freedom living on them. Another thing that happens is the gauge field also become matrices. And so you get a UN gauge theory. Some of this is telling you, well, you cannot really distinguish the brains from each other. You cannot tell me. There was no canonical base on this CN. And the ability to change the base or the CN in different places in space-time or different places along the D-brain becomes this gauge theory, this gauge symmetry in the string theory. So just adding D-brains, and in particular multiple stacks of D-brains, we gain access to a lot of interesting quantum field theory phenomena, and in particular non-abelian gauge theory. In practice, a lot of the applications of the whole holography came out of thinking about these sort of situations carefully. Let me see other features of deep brains which are remarkable. Another remarkable feature is that these sort of amplitudes enter in perturbation theory with a 1 over g, as opposed to the fact that a sphere would have given you a 1 over g squared, a torus would have given you a 1, and so on. This is sort of forced on you. And I think it's by unitarity. So if you try to check that the scattering is unitary, try to check that a complicated scattering diagram can be cut in different ways consistently, you kind of land on the fact that the disk had to sort of matter in some intermediate way compared to spheres and tori. And what I want to stress is that if you have a disk correlation function in a quantum field theory, I want to ask, how canonically normalized would a disk correlation function be? What can I do to this that would change? Suppose I pick, let me just forget about the vertex operators. This is just a, I'm not worrying about those. But what can I do that can change a sphere or a disk or a correlation function?
Maybe bring the points together.
No, I just mean in quantum field theory, so suppose I just allow you to touch the action. What can you do to the action which will multiply a correlation function by a number?
Besides the coupling? Besides the coupling? Or are you talking about setting the coupling, maybe?
Well, I mean, you can sort of try to add a constant to your action or something like that. So I'm not explaining myself very well, and I want to do a better job. So suppose what are the sort of possible counter terms I can encounter when I do a calculation with the boundary? I could have something like an integral of a constant, just the length of the boundary. It would be a reasonable counter term I could add to my calculation. But if you add a counter term like that, it turns out it's just it's like adding an energy, like shifting the ground state energy. It's like giving a constant t. It's actually not compatible with conformal invariance, with Weyl invariance, just because if I do a Weyl transformation, the length of the boundary will change. So in a Weyl invariant theory, you don't have freedom to just change the normalization of something. The only way you can change the normalization of a disk is by taking multiple copies of the D-brain. So you could have an N here if you had N copies of your D-brain, intuitively. So these sorts of disks will control things like, I don't know, how does a graviton interact with the D-brain? So they'll give you the charge, the mass, the tension of these D-brains from the point of view of the target space theory. And it's going to be quantized. There'll be some fixed amount. If I look at this D-brain has a specific tension proportional to 1 over the coupling. The only way I could find an object which is similar but has a bigger tension is by taking multiple copies of the D-brain. If I have n D-brains, I'll have something which is a tension n over g. Now, the fact that these D-brains have tensions of order g, 1 over g, means that they're lighter than a solution, a classical solution of gravity. Like a classical solution of gravity with an action, a tension, a mass, or whatever, of order 1 over g squared. So it's light. In this sort of back react like, so has a small back reaction. It sources fields of order g. But it's also heavy as g goes to 0. So g goes to 0 is simultaneously very heavy, but not too heavy, light enough that it doesn't create a big gravitational field. And this is what allows you to sort of treat it in perturbation theory. If you put a large number of them, then you can try to change this fact, try to get to a point where the back reaction is actually significant. And here you get into this whole open-closed duality idea that if I take a big stack of D-brains, then the effect they have on the string theory must be equivalent to the back reaction. Like if I make a black hole out of a bunch of D-brains, I should be able to treat it as a black hole. I should not have to know that I made it out of D-brains. And so you get to some kind of the idea that somehow this n by n matrices, this field valued in n by n matrices and their loops and contributions to the calculation must mimic somehow the effect of a black hole or something like that. And ultimately you get into holography. So the fact that you can simulate a space-time of a specific type out of fields which are large matrices. And so holography was precisely derived by taking a certain limit of a statement like that. And Mellacena's duality, the basic example of holography. Okay.
Are there things heavier than that?
Sure. I mean, if I find any classical solution, I could try to define string theory in the presence of that object. Now, in super string theory, you can ask the question, like, are there supersymmetric objects, perhaps, which are solutions of your theory, but don't look like D-brains? And yes, the answer is yes. There are things called NS5 brains, which we expect to exist, which they should be described by some modification of your worksheet theory, which is not quite clear. Some worksheet theory, which is not easy to describe as a free theory, and which describes the existence of these N5 brain objects sitting in your space-time. And there are other examples. Just for the last 5 minutes, I wanted to mention D-brains are not the only thing you can add to modify the story of string theory. There's another possibility to, which is to add non-orientable surfaces. They're hard to draw, for me at least. But there is something called a cross cap, for example. So, or a Mobius strip, a claim bottle. These are all non-orientable surfaces. And if you have a theory that is defined on non-orientable surfaces, you can try to define it on non-orientable surfaces too. There are some choices again, although less rich than the choices you have in defining boundary conditions, because locally you're not doing anything strange to your theory. I mean, the cross cap looks locally everywhere like a patch of sea. Just globally, the way you're gluing things together might have a little bit of freedom. So this leads to the notion of orientifold. Another thing you can do to the theory of closed strings to sort of add some object. And these are more or less the list of things we can do in the bosonic string, in theory of bosonic strings. And all of these are nonsensical because there is a tachyon everywhere. There are tachyons everywhere. So in order to find something which is more sensible, you need to introduce. There are many things which we know that there are many things we can do which should be sensible, simply because of the two-step expansion that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. Every time I have a quantum field theory of large matrices, pretty much I can treat it there is a limit in which it can be treated as a string theory. So there must be a whole bunch of string theories out there that make sense. But the ones that we build out of free fields on the worksheet, those are few. So the ones of which we can just do all calculations easily on the worksheet. And the ones we know are the sort of superstring theories. And I mean, what sort of free fields do you know? In 2D.
Bosons and fermion?
Yes, that's right. So in superstring theory, all you do is to say, okay, let me try to make sense of a situation where I have some bosons and some fermions. And then you add the idea that perhaps you have a symmetry that exchanges the bosons to the fermions on the worksheet. A supersymmetry. And just turn a crank with this idea. And you write a BRST differential, which is nilpotent, and so on. And you end up with something which lives in 10 dimensions. There are a few choices, because it turns out that even if you have fermions on the worksheet, you want the worksheet theory to be bosonic, in the sense that you don't need a spin structure to define it. So there is an operation called GSO projection, or gauge fermionic parity in condensed matter language, which throws away essentially things that are linear in the fermions and only keep bilinears. And so there are a couple of choices in doing GSO projection. So you might get a slightly different superstring theories. There is something called type 2A and type 2B, which are particularly nice. And then there are some non-supersymmetric ones that are less nice. And then there is a weird thing you can do where you do these only on holomorphic half of the degrees of freedom, while you use a bosonic string theory for the anti-holomorphic half. And that gives you a bunch of aterotic strings. So, and these are the things that people mean when they say string theory, usually. So people discovered all sorts of interesting. So because there's supersymmetry, there are a lot of quantities in these theories which are protected, like they don't depend on the coupling, or they depend in a very specific way on the coupling. And so you can sort of pretend that they're defined beyond perturbation theory and see if you can make sense of those protected things when the coupling is finite. And then you find interesting relations between these theories, which is, you know, this sort of web of dualities, which makes you feel that if they have a non-perturbative completion, these non-perturbative completions are all connected in some way. And furthermore, as I was saying, you can find holography in this context, and you can find well-defined quantum field theories, which at large n are expected to give you these superstring theories in some specific asymptotic backgrounds, in some universes in specific shape. Okay. Any questions? Any final questions? Well, we can continue asking questions. And the office hours can keep going until at least the end of May. Then I probably travel a bit. We can restart in late summer.
Can you have fermions but no supersymmetry?
Yes, yes. So there are these theories called 0A and 0B. And a bunch of others which are not supersymmetric in the target space. And they're less nice because without supersymmetry, you have no idea what's going to happen to the dilaton, pretty much. They still have no tachyon, they're just less controlled.
And I have a question about the brains. We decided to put Cn as our vector space.
Yes.
But can I put a qubit or Rn or can I put something else?
A qubit is just C2.
Why do we want complex degrees of freedom? Or that's on.
Because it's quantum mechanics.
Quantum mechanics.
I can totally ask if you can find study theories defined over the real numbers. But before you do this for the boundary conditions, but to do it for the bulk theory. It's kind of difficult to define theories which are both unitary and real. Also, time reversal symmetry gets close. But
so our fields don't obey any.
So what I'm trying to aim to is that when you start, if you start discussing cross caps and orientifolds, then you might find yourself in situations where you have a reality structure, and so you might find SO or SP as gauge fields on the brains. So the answer is yes-ish. You can make, there are situations where it matters that you can say Rn instead of Cn, but those are only situations where you have time reversal symmetry on the worksheet and you're using it. And that's precisely having a cross cap, having reflection on the worksheet included in the gauge, in the things you use to glue the worksheets together.
And those are non-oriented strings?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Oh, usually you just say you put an orientifold in your string theory. Because you know you're doing, it's again a correction of order 1 over G. But there is no N. So of course you can have both deep brains and orientifolds. And that's when the deep brains can have SO and SP. If you're trying to define an amplitude on a Möbius strip, you might find yourself in a situation you want to have R N on the boundary.
Your question is, we were discussing at some point that like the reason the Chan-Pitten factors are giving you N gauge fields is related to some reality condition on the
UN is supposed to Gen or
yes, that was the thing we weren't understanding.
Was maybe if I'm labeling where I start and end, then that's like a real, why does that have to be
so called? I think there is a fun question I can ask back.
And we are confused about UN is UN.
So let me ask the following question. If suppose I have a scalar field and I treat it in perturbation theory, does it make sense to ask if the scalar field is real or imaginary? Will it make any difference? Or even better, suppose I have a Gaussian integral. Let me put an I don't know, so it looks more like a Lorentzian thing, I don't know. Does it make any difference if I say that X is real or imaginary? No, it's the same integral. Same answer. The perturbation theory knows nothing about the reality condition on the fields. Would it make sense to ask if it's complex? Yes, but only in the sense that I can decide to enter it both over imaginary and real parts. And then I can do something like this, for example. Or something like that. Anyway. Or absolute value of x squared, or, you know. So here I just had twice as many degrees of freedom as I have here. That's definitely a big change. So here, the only thing that is sensible to say is that I have 1 degree of freedom for every mu a, b. Asking if this is UN gauge field, or an U2 gauge field, SU2 gauge field, or an SL2R gauge field. In perturbation theory, you're not going to be able to see the difference. It's definitely not an SL2C gauge field, because an SL2C gauge field, there are two fields for every entry. Then when you try to define a unitary theory, you'll find that, I mean, if you try to go beyond perturbation theory and a gauge theory, UN definitely has better features than other non-compact real forms of the gauge group, because it's compact. So in particular, the volume of the gauge group of constant gauge transformation is infinite. This avoids a whole bunch of, and also then the if you look at the unitarity condition for the photons, for the gluons, if you try to use SL2R instead of SU2, you'll find that some gluons are the wrong unitarity, wrong norm, wrong sign norm. So there is a UN invariant positive definite norm on the Lie algebra. You don't have an SL2R invariant positive definite norm on the Lie algebra, I think. So this is the answer. In perturbation theory, it makes no difference. And then UN is the sensible thing beyond perturbation theory. The most sensible thing, but you can do other things sometimes.
And you have a t-shirt and a personally.
Thank you.
And there is a marble brownie for the class.
Oh, thank you.